$1 billion in oil revenues that have been frozen due to U.S. sanctions. The deal is on track, according to National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, but don't get too excited. That's me saying that. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, "Nothing about our overall approach to Iran has changed. We continue to pursue a strategy of deterrence, of pressure, and diplomacy."
So that deal that you referenced is a reflection that the two countries are talking, but they're really talking over the status of these Iranian prisoners, Iranian-American prisoners, who effectively are hostages, and they're being bartered or bargained in exchange for sanction relief. If you look at the details of what's been negotiated, the idea is that Iran will not have direct access to these frozen funds that are actually right now in a South Korean bank account, but the money that South Korea has will be transferred to Qatar, and Iran will be able to charge food purchases and medicines to that account, which the Qatari government will then process and then send to Iran. And in that way, the Biden administration can claim that they're not giving into Iran, they're not sort of releasing or relieving pressure, that the existing sanctions still stay in place. The official position of the Biden administration is that food and medicine are not part of the sanctions regime. In exchange for that going forward, these Iranian-American hostages will be released from Iran roughly over the next, 4 to 5 weeks. But as you said correctly, David, that remains to be seen.
A University of Colorado professor was concerned about that money, once it's returned to Iran, would go into the pockets of the mullahs and the ayatollahs. So you just addressed that a mechanism has been set up where, at least in theory, that won't happen.
Exactly correct. If you look at the New York Times reporting on this, by a very good, at least, reporter who covers Iran, Farnaz Fasihi, when she broke the story, she goes into considerable detail of exactly what was negotiated. Unfortunately, a lot of commentators on Iran, I think, don't know the details and think that, this is $6 billion. It's going to go in the pocket of the supreme leader to spend as he wishes. No. Well, that's not what has been negotiated, and anyone familiar with the details will, I think, affirm that fact.
The U.S. recently increased its already extensive military presence in the Gulf, accusing Iran of seizing and intercepting ships. There's always an on-again, off-again cat-and-mouse game with threats and counter-threats, saber-rattling and warmongering, and then there's a kind of cooling off. These ebbs and flows have continued throughout this decades-long confrontation between the two countries. Now, to talk about Israel, which has the most right-wing regime in its history, might it launch an attack on Iran and the consequences of that?
Well, there's always that fear that Israel will claim that Iran is getting close to producing a nuclear weapon and it has no choice but to attack Iran. My own view is that I don't think Israel, even under this extremely hawkish right-wing government, would be able or willing to attack Iran unless the United States gave their blessing. And the Biden administration is an administration that I think very much wants to focus attention on China, Russia, and Ukraine. It doesn't want to get into another war. And so my sense is that the possibility of an Israeli strike over Iran's nuclear program is not really on the horizon, at least in the near future, but it's always a cause for concern. Were that to happen, then I think all bets are off and we're headed toward a major Middle Eastern war, which we came pretty close to when Trump was in power. And the moment that I'm referring to was very much in January of 2020, when Donald Trump approved the assassination of Iran's top general in Baghdad, Qasem Soleimani, leading to an Iranian retaliatory strike on American military bases in Iraq. And then there was a fear that Trump would then retaliate against Iran for hitting the American military bases. And Iran at the time announced that were the United States to hit Iranian targets within Iran, Iran would go after Tel Aviv and Dubai, thus leading to an immediate regional war. Thankfully, there was de-escalation. But at that time, I remember speaking to a journalist very much fearful that we were headed toward another Middle Eastern war. So that's why I'm very concerned about the future, because, one wrong misperception or misunderstanding can easily trigger a war. There is no direct communication on a consistent basis between the two governments. And without that, the possibility of, you know, a misunderstanding, someone seizes a ship and then there's a perceived sort of counter response that could easily escalate into something quite catastrophic.
It would be suicide for the government in Tehran to launch any kind of military action against the United States. I mean, they'd effectively be, you know, committing suicide.
Correct. And I think the regime knows that. And it's important to realize this is not a regime that has lasted 44 years by accident. It calculates very carefully. And in terms of its foreign policy and defense strategy, it pursues a strategy known as passive defense, rooted in asymmetric warfare, knowing that it can't, you know, confront the United States and its military prowess face to face. So it engages in this types of, you know, tanker battles, seizing hostages of dual citizens is a way that the Islamic Republic, in a very sort of deeply unethical way, basically ruining the lives of innocent people who go to Iran to visit family, then they end up in prison and then used as bargaining chips. These are the tactics of the Islamic Republic that it uses to get concessions and leverage from the United States. And unfortunately, this is going to continue until there's some sort of, you know, shift on both sides, on one of the two sides. I mean, there was a lot of hope, I think, when Obama was elected and he negotiated the nuclear agreement, that we had turned the tide, that this would lead to perhaps, you know, a significant reduction in tensions. And that was widely celebrated both within Iran at the time. People forget that. Democratic and human rights forces were very happy with the JCPOA at the time because it meant lifting of sanctions and there would be a chance for Iranian civil society and the middle class to breathe. And that perhaps that would be a turning point. But of course, it wasn't to be because of the election of 2016, which brought, you know, Trump back to power and then led very, you know, very, we came very close under Trump several times to a war with Iran.
In an article, The Struggle for Democracy in Iran, you wrote, the U.S. has a unique moral responsibility to support democracy in Iran. Why is that? Is that because of the coup?
Yes, because in 1953, Iran had a very, I think, deep-rooted and significant pro-democracy experience that it was going through. It had a popular democratic leader who was in power, who had a lot of popular support. And that coup effectively put an end to what I think was the best prospects for democracy Iran in its modern history. And of course, that coup was a CIA coup that was cooked up in Washington, D.C., in close alliance with the United Kingdom. And so one has to just ask themselves, you know, had that coup not taken place, had Mohammad Mossadegh remained in power, had the struggle for democracy continued on its own momentum and in the direction that it was heading, how different might Iran be today under a democratic political system? How different might the Middle East be today had that coup not taken place? How different might the Islamic world be today if in the heart of the Islamic world you had an authentic indigenous democracy that supported human rights? I mean, we don't know the answers to those questions. But what we do know is that coup put an end to the best hope for democratic secular politics in Iran during the 20th century. It led to the rise of a religious-based opposition politics, and it set the stage for the 1979 revolution. And then we know the rest of the history. So I think in that sense, Americans who are interested in rewriting the wrongs of the past in questions of historical injustice have to, I think, view the case of Iran and the struggle for democracy in Iran with, I think, a unique moral responsibility, because we put an end to the best prospects for democracy in Iran in 1953. And that should be part of the national debate. And it should inform, you know, how Americans think about this topic. Unfortunately, it doesn't. But that's why I made that observation.
In that same Struggle for Democracy article, you wrote, authoritarian regimes are the key incubators and sources of instability in the region. They're not the answer. They are the core problem.
Yeah, the view in Washington very much is that, look, these regimes, notwithstanding all their warts and shortcomings, they're the only game in town. They protect our interests. They want to make nice with Israel. They allow for businesses to invest in the region. they create a certain sort of tranquility, and all of the other options allegedly are much worse. I'm of the view that that's a very short-term, very short-sighted, and very immoral way to look at these authoritarian regimes. It's precisely these authoritarian regimes that I think produce the type of radicalism, extremism, and instability that the region has seen in the last 50 years. I mean, just to cite one example, I can cite dozens. It's not a coincidence that on September 11th, 2001, 15 of the 19 hijackers came from one country, Saudi Arabia. And they were not the poorest of the poor. They were middle-class kids who were radicalized, thinking that the best way that they could make a contribution to their life on this planet is to engage in that type of suicidal violence. And so in many ways, this is part of the problem. I mean, getting back to Iran, you cannot understand, you shouldn't understand the 1979 revolution and what's happened since then, unless you understand the authoritarian policies of the pro-American regime that the United States installed after the 1953 coup. It was precisely the policies of the Shah of Iran that created that incubator effect for radicalism and extremism that culminated in the 79 revolution. So I think that's the way to view these things. Authoritarianism is not the solution to the problems of the Middle East. In many ways, it's the core problem of the instability in the Middle East.
And see how it intersects with U.S. foreign policy. And the hypocrisy and double standards of that policy have been a constant in the Middle East. Washington selectively supports authoritarian regimes such as Egypt and Saudi Arabia. You'll recall Biden labeled Riyadh as a pariah. And just recently, Human Rights Watch reports the Saudi killing of hundreds of Ethiopian migrants and asylum seekers.
And the tragedy, of course, with respect to that Human Rights Watch report, David, that you just referenced, is as we are speaking, the Biden administration is in negotiations with the Saudis and the Israelis to provide security guarantees to the notorious Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia if he agrees to sign a normalization agreement with Israel. On the hypocrisy question, we shouldn't be forgotten that, yes, there's always been double standards and hypocrisy, but so glaring at this moment is that we are hearing from the Biden administration that our world now is facing a historic and cosmic struggle between the forces of democracy and authoritarianism. And of course, these are themes that are invoked in the context of Europe, Ukraine, Russia, that this is a defining moment. We have to rally around what's called a rules-based order. We have to oppose war crimes. We have to back democracies. The exact same members of the Biden administration give these types of sort of, you know, heroic speeches in Europe. And often on the next day, we'll get on a plane, go to the Middle East, and embrace every single despot, dictator, and repressive regime who stands for the exact opposite. And nobody picks up on the glaring inconsistency and hypocrisy. It's almost stunning how that doesn't evoke the type of outrage. But at least those of us who study the region, you know, are really, you know, taken aback by the ongoing insult to our collective intelligence that this type of hypocrisy continues to invoke when we hear these speeches from our esteemed leaders in Washington, D.C.
Earlier this year, China brokered a deal to restore relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I mean, the two countries were at loggerheads for quite a number of years. Why did Iran enter this agreement? And this must have been a bit of a shock to the U.S., which likes to
control
everything.
It was a huge shock. Yeah, it was a huge shock to the U.S. It was a bigger shock in Israel. Iran is, you know, under tight sanctions. I think it viewed relations with Saudi Arabia as a way of breaking out from the sanctions and the stranglehold that they've been put under by the American government, both under, you know, Trump and Biden. So in that sense, I think there was an economic incentive for the Iranians to sign that deal. Of course, Iran does want to get closer to China. It views China's role in the international system, particularly in the Middle East, as a counterweight to the United States' presence. So it was very much interested in having the Chinese broker a deal. I think that was really what was driving the Iranian side of the bargain.
And you have also Iran being invited to join the BRICS grouping of countries, you know, breaking away from the U.S.-dominated global economic system, the significance of that if it
I think it's
happens.
significant. Yeah, I think it's very significant. I'm glad you raised it, David, because it shows that, in fact, the news today is that Iran has been formally admitted. And I think the significance of it is it shows that the United States will no longer be able to determine, I think, which countries in the world, particularly in the Middle East, can be isolated and cut off economically from the rest of the world. Iran's membership into this organization will allow it to sort of have some leverage over U.S. foreign policy and sanctions. It gives it an opening to facilitate its economic relations with other countries. Now, I don't think that that doesn't mean that U.S. influence over Iran ends tomorrow. It reminds us that I think global power politics are shifting, that the United States' ability to unilaterally write the rules, particularly in the Middle East, that period is slowly ending. I think the Iranian regime is going to try and exploit that for all it's worth. I think it has more symbolic importance. I don't think there's going to be a big economic shift in the reality of Iran's economy because of that admission to the BRICS group. But I think it does give us a sense of where things are headed for the future in terms of international relations.
Iran is supplying weaponry, particularly drones, to Russia. Why?
Russia is Iran's major ally. It relies on, you know, Russia's support at the UN Security Council. Russia and Iran have trading relations. Russia is now involved in war. It also, this is a way of getting back at the United States. The United States is heavily invested in the war in Ukraine. And so Iran has an incentive in supporting the major adversary of the United States and of the West, you know, in the context of the Ukraine war. My own sense, though, is that this talk about Iranian drones being a huge factor in the Ukraine war is somewhat exaggerated. Let's not forget that Russia is the superpower here and Iran is a, you know, a developing country. Iran is not known for weapons manufacturing. The talk that we're hearing about these Iranian drones in Ukraine being a major factor, I think, is disproportionate to the actual reality on the ground. So I think we have to keep that in perspective. I think what the real story here is why Russia, which is a major weapons manufacturer, why Russia had to rely on these Iranian drones so heavily. I think it's really a commentary on the sad state of the Russian military, that it's relying on a third world country like Iran to supply it with drones. And I think much of the media frenzy over this is a byproduct of the fact that, look, two adversaries of the United States are sort of engaging in military relations here to push back against Ukraine, and that's something that the United States doesn't want to see happen. And so there's a lot of concern over this, but I don't think the war in Ukraine is in the condition that it's in because of these Iranian drones. I think that's largely an overreaction.
Like other parts of the globe, Iran has endured long periods of drought and record-breaking temperatures. What steps is the government taking to mitigate the effects of the climate crisis?
Very little to my knowledge. And I think that's an answer that applies to many other authoritarian regimes in the Middle East. Authoritarian regimes in the Middle East, their fundamental focus and obsession is staying in power and repressing dissent. That's where the energy, that's where the budget, that's where the, you know, that's the focus of policy, of politics in these countries, including in Iran. So there's been very little preparation for the looming catastrophe that has already hit the Middle East, but it's going to get worse. According to all, you know, reports that we have, the Middle East is disproportionately affected by climate change. Large parts of southern Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, the Persian Gulf area will be uninhabitable in the coming years because of climate change. And there's been no preparation for this looming catastrophe. So this adds another layer, I think, of concern that the region is facing. We're on top of all of the, you know, problems that authoritarian policies and U.S. and Western policy has produced for the region. There is now this problem of climate change that is going to, you know, have catastrophic effects, of course, on the poor and on the innocent and on the vulnerable. The rich and the affluent will have options to exercise, but those people who don't have those resources are going to be bearing the brunt of the climate change crisis, which is hitting the Middle East, hitting Iran in very catastrophic ways. And it's just an added reason to be very concerned about the future of this region.
What's your go-to media source on Iran?
I really like the Center for Human Rights in Iran. It's probably the most credible, effective, competent, and reliable news source for events happening on the ground in Iran from a human rights perspective. It was founded by this wonderful, really brilliant human rights activist, Hadi Qaimi. They put out consistent reports. Then, of course, there's because I can read Persian, I rely on a lot of the Persian language sources. The BBC Persian service has a wonderful reporting on events in Iran, really competent people. It's precisely because of their high quality journalism that staff members, Iranian staff members at the BBC in London, are targeted by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Their families are arrested and harassed because they do such reporting. And, all reports are that within Iran, it's the BBC Persian service that's the most popular because it does provide that type of, accurate news coverage. The Guardian, has, I think, good coverage of Iran. I follow what Human Rights Watch puts out on Iran regularly. So those are the main sources. There's good journalists. I think actually the New York Times journalist on Iran, Fahnaz Fasihi, does cover Iran with a lot of competency and honesty. So those are the places that I turn to.
Where do you see the struggle for democracy in Iran heading?
Well, I think it's going to remain in a state of paralysis. It's going to have its ebb and its flow. The regime is still very much in power. And it's willing to use a lot of violence to stay in power. So I don't anticipate any changes in the short term. But I think one thing to watch for is when the current supreme leader dies. He's 85 years old. I think he has maybe at most 5 to 10 years left. When he passes from the scene, because he is the most powerful figure in the Iranian political system, that's going to be a moment of crisis that perhaps democratic forces in Iran can exploit. It's not going to be a moment of celebration for hardline forces in Iran. It's going to be a moment of deep uncertainty. And so that's something to watch for going forward with respect to the future of Iranian democracy.
There's always the question of what people can do in terms of solidarity to improve human rights in Iran and the struggle for democracy.
Think there's a lot that can be done. US policy remains a problem. I think these broad-based sanctions need to be rethought, removed, and applied in a much more systematic way. I'm strongly in favor of targeted sanctions against people who have blood on their hands, but I would be much more in favor of sanctions that don't affect the average citizen in Iran and that actually is used in more constructive ways to advance the struggle for democracy in Iran. There's no, I think, easy answer there, but that's, I think, one problem. So being vigilant in terms of what U.S. foreign policy is toward Iran is something that people can be doing. And on a much more practical level, I think we claim that we support the struggle for democracy in Iran in the United States, but we make it very difficult for Iranian students to travel here. So I think having an immigration policy that makes it easier for Iranians who want to come here and study or live, that's something that can be done. I think also supporting the work of courageous human rights defenders. I mean, there's a lot of very heroic Iranian human rights defenders in Iran, many of them who are in and out of jail, some of them who are in prison right now, people like Nargis Mohammadi, like Nasrin Sotoudeh. Follow their lead, follow, what they can tell us about how to better support the struggle for democracy in Iran. One of the things that I learned actually from you, David, a very long time ago, was an interview that you conducted with Professor Noam Chomsky when he made the observation and it really resonated in me. He said that if you want to help a group of people on the other side of the world, you have to, at the beginning, exercise some humility and don't presuppose that you know what the answers are for them in advance. You need to consult with, familiarize yourself with organically connected, credible leaders in the community that you're hoping to help. Listen to what they're saying and then adjust your advocacy and activism in close coordination with those organically connected democratic leaders. So that is, I think, a rule of thumb that I have when it comes to helping, whether it's the people of Iran or any other community fighting for democracy and human rights. You have to familiarize yourself with those leaders that have street credibility and that can guide us in our activism. So that's the advice that I give to people.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, David.
You were just listening to Nader Hashemi on Iran, the struggle for democracy. Nader Hashemi is director of the Al-Walid Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent, progressive nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Medea Benjamin, Arundhati Roy, Uma Shakir, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Nader Hashemi on Iran, the struggle for democracy, and for the book, Retargeting Iran, featuring Nader Hashemi, Azadeh Moevani, and others, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to Your Daily Progressive News, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
Broadcast.